Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, March 20th, 2008. The main science topics tonight will deal with survival made simple. Want to just do a little summary on that, because many people are interested in what we call survival. What does it really mean, and how should you be, what should you be doing today? Can you expect to just run out one day and have volumes of stuff stored and all of a sudden know how to survive? The answer to that is no. So what do you do on a daily basis to get ready to survive? And this would be people living in urban situations, in the country. Some people are more prepared than others. Some people think they're prepared but really aren't. So I'll try and simplify that, give you a few basic rules. The other main science topics dealing with real hardcore science, entropy. What in the world is entropy? And if I'll talk about the what entropy actually is in scientific terms, and then I'll discuss the many types of comets. There are many different types of comets, and I'll talk about those, not just necessarily the kind you see up in the sky at night like Comet Holmes, but there are many types of comets moving around our solar system, and so I'll talk about that. Now, just to begin with, I'm going to talk about organic and hybrid seeds, because having seeds, having your own source of food, is very important to survival. If you go to the store, many times you see what are called organic seeds. Sounds pretty impressive, organic, but what's really inside that little package of seeds are hybrid seeds. They'll grow for a single season. They might make big, impressive fruit or corn or vegetables or tomatoes, whatever. But then when you take those seeds from that, from the final fruit, vegetable, whatever, they won't grow again. That's a hybrid. It's a genetically engineered product. And part of the genetic engineering, in fact, some things have actually been engineered to not even have seeds. So you might grow a watermelon and cut it open just to discover there are no seeds in it. Well, that's wonderful. Wonderful when you go to eat it, but then when you want to regrow it, if you're in a situation where you're depending on seeds for your food, you're not going to have any. And many, well, in the case of hybrids, if you take a seed out of a squash or a watermelon or, you know, a tomato or a cucumber and dry it out, it will not grow, or it might grow some measly little plant, but it won't create food for you. So be very aware of your source of seeds. Now, there are some legitimate good sources of seeds, planting and sprouting seeds on the market, but you have to be very careful, and don't be impressed by that little seed package that says organic, because if that's all it says, 9 times out of 10, it's a hybrid. Now, there are hybrid trees, and here's one of the problems with hybrids. They will disrupt non-hybrid plants. So if you plant cucumbers that are hybrids next to non-hybrid, non-hybrid being the better seed that will reproduce and give you seeds, if you plant hybrids next to the non-hybrids, then the hybrids will cross-pollinate and destroy the non-hybrids. So you want to keep your plants isolated, well away from anybody who is gardening with hybrid seeds. So let me just go through this again, because this is a little bit confusing for people who have heard it for the first time. or maybe you know a little bit about seeds but are not familiar with this hybrid issue. It's one of the least reported, least known about issues with seeds. Once again, organic simply means that it's grown under organic conditions, that there are no chemicals, chemical fertilizers, pesticides, all of those things. And organic may mean many different things to different people. Unfortunately, Congress watered down the meaning of hybrid a number of years ago, allowing big industry to use almost anything and claiming that it's organic. So you really have to know your source. The organic industry fought that legislation tooth and nail and lost, basically. So things on the market today that say organic, many of them are not. But organic simply means that whatever it is was grown under non-chemical conditions. Let's put it that way. Hybrid is a totally, totally different issue. Hybrid has to do with the seeds. Now, hybrid, let's say this. Let's just make an equation. Hybrid is bad. Non-hybrid is good. Hybrid means somebody chemically, or somebody, some corporation genetically engineered those seeds, and what they do many times is they take the seeds from numerous varieties, and it'll make it resistant to certain kinds of bugs or bacteria or infections of the plant, which is deemed to be good by some people, but then every year you have to go back and buy the seeds. And this all started back in the, let's say the 50s. Farmers used to save their own seeds. And so they would grow their crop of corn or soybeans from what they picked out as the best seed from the previous year. And they would trade, there were farmer exchanges for seeds, for alfalfa, etc. So they had a constant mixing of the varieties of plants that they would grow on the farm. Corn, tomatoes, whatever they grew. And so the farmers actually did this. And here comes the big corporations and they go, how can we make a profit on the farmer? How can we create a plant and make him dependent on it so that he will have to come back to us every year and buy a product? So they created the hybrid, these hybrid plants, corn, soybeans, etc., that grew tremendous crops with a certain type of fertilizer and pesticides, and they looked like gorgeous crops, and you'd get a lot of money from your crop. But every year, you now had to go back to that corporation and buy your seed. So the hybrid was a way of profitizing off farming, one of the ways. Non-hybrid seeds, luckily, there were groups that went out, saw this coming, and said, we have to save the seed bank, the original seeds of corn, of tomatoes, of cucumbers, etc. And there are sources. So look on the internet. I'm not going to give any particular ones. I'm not going to promote any locations, but you can find them. Look for non-hybrid seeds. And in general, they will also be very organic oriented. So look for non-hybrid. Non-hybrid equals good. That's what you want, and those are the seeds. Now, there are books telling you how to dry the seeds, save them, and then plant them the next year. You also want to exchange seeds with people. You want to get their seeds that are non-hybrid, and you got to be very careful because some people out there don't know what they're doing. So I would deal with a trusted source of hybrid seeds. Find one, buy and create your own seed bank. Now, I just read an article recently. They just opened up the International Seed Bank, and it's up in the Arctic. I can't remember exactly where it is. I think it's up in the Arctic Circle or something, or possibly it's in Antarctica. I forget, but it's a cave where they're trying to preserve the world seed collection. And I get a little worried because I wonder how many hybrid seeds have slipped into that seed bank that would then destroy the original seed banks. But what they're trying to do is collect all of the seeds from around the earth for natural grasses, for plants that grow on earth, anything that grows, basically, get the seeds and put it in the seed bank. But you should create your own. Buy enough seeds so that you have your own source of non-hybrid seeds. Non-hybrid is good. Hybrid is bad. And so, anyway, I spent a little time on that because I want you to really understand and find one of those sources of non-hybrid seeds. As I said, they will most generally be organic also. And get yourself a seed bank. Get a variety of seeds, of greens, of tomatoes, of vegetables. And then also get yourself a couple 50-pound bags or 25-pound bags of red winter wheat. Those are your mainstays. And then go buy corn, ground corn or whole corn, have those. That's what your staples are going to be in case of survival. So when I talk about food, you're storing grains. You're not going to eat a lot of meat or fish or other proteins like that. You probably won't have eggs. A lot of the things you're used to, you will not have, but you do need the plants to grow for sprouting, etc. So I'm sorry I spent so much time talking about this, but it's extremely important. That is part of your daily survival package. And now, the other part I'll be talking about in a second is that you should be doing this every day. You should be sprouting seeds and eating the sprouts and learning how to juice the juice from sprouts. You should have a juicer. You should have a hand grain grinder. And don't get the electric juicer. Don't get the electric grain grinder. Get the hand crank ones. Start using it. Learn how to use it so that you can make your own bread, even if it's unleavened bread. And what you're going to find is that you're going to lose weight, you're going to be healthy, and you'll be very surprised at your physical condition. And so I'll be talking about all of these and a few more items in the section when I talk about survival made simple. So just remember the issues about organic and non-hybrid seeds. Non-hybrid equals good. Hybrid equals bad. Okay, and by the way, many seed vendors do not know what hybrid even means. I was surprised. I went to a nursery where they sell to vast amounts of products to the public, and the head guy, I asked one of the women, I said, where are your non-hybrid seeds? And I asked, and they had all of this seed variety out there for sale. And so she didn't know, so she called the owner manager over, and I talked to him. I said, which of these are non-hybrid? And he goes, what do you mean, non-hybrid? And I said, I mean non-hybrid. I said, what of your seed varieties here that you're selling are non-hybrid? He didn't even know. He didn't even know what non-hybrid meant. He didn't know what hybrid meant. This is the owner manager of a big nursery seed store. So be careful of your source. I would look on the internet for the distribution businesses that specialize in seed saving and saving seeds that are non-hybrid. They sometimes call them heirloom seeds. So at any rate, check that out, and I'll talk more about that in the Survival Made Simple section in just a minute. The world economy, of course, is collapsing. U.S. dollars not being accepted in many parts of the world now. It's because it's falling so fast. The military is putting edicts in place. You know, all of the congressional and presidential directives that are being put in place just tells us that something, we're on the verge of a big collapse. This is exactly the same conditions that existed in pre-World War II Germany. Hyperinflation, planned collapse of the stock market with certain companies taking over the stock market and corporations for pennies on the dollar, taking over private property because it's defaulting and than money being infused into the pockets of the rich, like with the Bear Stearns bailout, that money went to the rich investors. All of these conditions are exactly the same. And by the way, all of that money that went to Bear Stearns to bail them out went to the rich investors who were making a call on that private corporation. This money came from the Federal Reserve, which is a private European bank that has taken over our monetary system in this country, and through interest and inflation and deflation has rooped the American public out of their houses now. So this is exactly what happened in World War II Germany. This economic cycle and the process, or the laundry list of things that they're doing, has been done many times before. Remember Mexico in the 1980s when they had hyperinflation and the peso went to become worthless, and those foreign banks went in and took over the nationalized banking system of Mexico. That's what's happening here. So once again, I'm just going to quickly read this quote from Alexander Tyler, who wrote this when the 13 colonies were still before the revolution, before they separated from England, wrote about the Athenian Republic and many others who had fallen within a 200-year period. It says, a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves money from the public treasure. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most money from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's great civilizations has been 200 years. Gee, I wonder if we've been around for 200 years. These nations have progressed through the following sequence: from bondage to spiritual faith, from spiritual faith to great courage, from courage to liberty, from liberty to abundance, from abundance to selfishness, from selfishness to complacency, and from complacency to apathy, from apathy to dependency, and from dependency back to bondage. This was written before the 13 colonies became independent states. So they knew that the lifetime of our democracy would only be a couple hundred years. So with that in mind, it's happening. It's pretty much all over. The United States is collapsing economically. And I personally would expect some kind of an event here. And of course, they want to attack Iran, who is leading somewhat the world for disposing of the U.S. dollar, the fiat money that runs the United States. So anyway, in light of this, this is not a show about economics, but I do talk about survival. And so, as I said, one of the main topics is survival made simple. Okay, so you might want to take notes. Very simply, here's what you do. You should be living every day in a survival mode. You should be doing this in your house, apartment, wherever you are, and learn how to live without the infrastructure, maybe 1 or 2 days a week. Turn off the water. See what it's going to take for you to live. Do not expect to walk out one day and all of a sudden be a survivalist and learn how to use your water filter and grow food and sustain yourself. It's not going to happen. You have to be doing this on a daily basis. Congress and the government are useless. They now are owned and controlled. All branches of the government are basically in default, you might say. They're basically paid off. They are in the greed patrol, so to speak, and they are basically worthless. So you are going to have to take care of yourself. They even own the local and the county, municipality, city governments are all, when this thing goes down, they will all be under the control of the federal government. So there again, your city entities will be absolutely worthless. The first thing they will do is shut off your water. So you have to be your source of fresh water, which means you have to filter it. food, you have to learn how to use grains for sprouting, for making your own simple bread, probably unleavened bread. And so you have to have grains stored up, corn and other types of grains, wheat, etc. And you can buy those in bulk. You'd be surprised how inexpensive rice, those things in bulk, beans, etc. Shelter is the third thing. Stay in your house. Learn how to live within your house. The 99% of the time when people run into trouble in a survival mode is when they are not prepared and they have to leave their location. Just remember that. You have to be prepared to stay where you are. If at all possible, be away from the cities. That's where 99% of the problems are going to happen. Shoes. Most people would not understand that in a survival situation, your most important piece of clothing are your shoes, boots, socks, your ability to keep your feet dry and warm, your ability to walk around and do whatever you have to do. You're not going to have gas. You probably aren't going to have any fuel for your generator. You're going to have to exist without all of these amenities. So, and then exercise, be in shape, exercise every day, stretched, be in good physical condition, because you're going to need it going into some survival mode. So once again, the five things that you want to remember, first of all, the first thing you want to remember is nobody's going to come to help you. You should be doing this every day, and do not expect to walk out one day and all of a sudden become a survivalist. So the five things you need, made simple, survival made simple, clean water, food from grains, shelter, stay in your house, shoes, boots, and socks, and exercise. Water, food, shelter, shoes, exercise. The five essentials. And then communication. Be able to communicate with the people that are necessary, but you better be where you're going and don't expect a lot of communication after this goes down. So once again, the big five items for survival made simple. Water. You have to be your own source of water. It has to be in a gravity-fed system that is portable. You can put it under your arm and take it with you. No matter where you go, you're going to have clean water. That's number one. Number two, food, grains. People talk about bottled water. How much bottled water can you carry around with you? A water filter weighs about 4 pounds. One gallon of water weighs 6 pounds. So how much water are you going to carry around with you? And bottled water, I would not depend on it at all. Your tap water is probably going to be shut off, so your inline filter is not going to work. Well water, the same way. Electricity will probably be out, so your well may not even work. Surface, lake, and stream water will probably be your sources of water. So, and all of it has to be filtered, including rainwater. Water, grains is for food, shelter, stay in your house, shoes, and exercise. The essentials of survival made simple. Okay, on to the next topic here. This past week, it was announced in the news that in Peru, September 2007, a meteorite hit and impacted the ground in Peru. And it was very strange because most meteorites of the size they were talking about, just a small one, most of them break up and disintegrate and fly apart into multiple pieces long before they hit the ground. So the estimate was that this came in at around 15,000 miles per hour and should have exploded, heated up, and vaporized long before it hit the ground. Now, the part that I want to discuss here is when this hit the ground, people came around to look at it. There was a dust cloud that emanated from the impact site, and people became sick, and animals died in that area. And so now they're trying to downplay the people getting sick and animals dying part of this story. So that's what I want to accentuate here, that typically meteorites would possibly contain viruses that they pick up as they move through outer space. And I've made it clear before, this is even in the medical journals, it's well known that outer space has viruses. And these, how they are created out there is still not fundamentally known, but we know from the Chinese going all the way back to 1200 AD when the Chinese started documenting what they called the swine flu that occurred when Venus was at an inferior conjunction. In other words, when Venus came around between us and the sun, the flu epidemics began. And so it went from the swine who first contracted it, and then it went to chickens and birds, commonly known as the bird flu, and then that migrated into a form that would infect humans. So it was like a three-step process. And that's why it seems that the influenza, this, or I wouldn't even call it influenza, the virus that was going around began around last November and carried around the world. Basically, people are still sick from this, incapacitated with this strange virus. And I don't know if that's where it came from or if it came from a man-made, say, a military virus that was injected into the society. I really can't say for certain. People have asked me, and I don't have an answer for that. I wish I had a good viral lab to refer that question to, but I don't. But the timing is rather interesting with the inferior conjunction of Venus last fall. Also concurrent with the Comet Holmes alignment where Mercury, Venus, Mars, and Comet Holmes all aligned very exactly, and that's what kicked off Comet Holmes on the 23rd of October last fall, if you remember. So back to the Peruvian meteorite, the point here is that meteorites or asteroids, whatever, that are floating around out there are sweeping through space and over time would collect and harbor viruses. When this item impacted in Peru, it made a crater about 10 feet across. And as I said, it was emitting vapors and dust when the first people arrived at the scene. And a lot of those people got sick. So it would be similar to, I suppose, like it could have been due to gases being emitted from the meteor impact site, or it could have been due to viruses that immediately these people contracted and became sick. And of course, as I said, the scientific community doesn't want to talk about that aspect of this. They just want to talk about the hole in the ground and the fact that this did not break up upon re-entry or upon entry into Earth's atmosphere. So what's the point here? The point is that from history, from the historical record, we have a very good records of people getting sick when the vast comet event happened a number of thousands of years ago, what we might call the Velikovsky event or the Venus event, and there were rains of what they called brimstone and fire, the naphtha, the burning oil, the hydrocarbons coming into the atmosphere, and the rain of meteoric material that also accompanied that passage of that large comet. And of course, we spent about 40 days and 40 nights in the tail of that comet. That was the source of the worldwide flood, the glaciation, the death of the large animals, the mastodons, the woolly mammoths, the saber-toothed tiger, and almost the extinction of man himself due to the passage of that comet and the onset of the ice age, which we are now just barely getting out of. We're on the final throes of warming up after that ice age. caused by moving Earth moving through a comet tail, robbing us of sunlight, dumping tremendous amounts of water into our atmosphere, as well as hydrocarbons and other meteoric material. But the people are very specific. They talk about the Earth, the boiling Earth, and the influx of this kind of material from above. And you see standard science working its hardest to try and pretend like that never happened. Okay, on to the next topic. The main science topic, I said, would be entropy. Now, this is a term that many people may have heard, but are not really familiar with what it means. Entropy, there are a number of forms of energy transfer, that are summarized in the three laws of thermodynamics. And entropy is one of them. Now, basically, entropy says that if you have an organized system, whether it's molecules, no matter what it is, it will tend to become disorganized by itself as a natural result of nature working, so to speak. And so the question is one of the laws or rules of the universe to have things. Let's take a box full of air, and let's compress all the air up to one corner and hold it there for just a second and then let go. And the question is, well, what's going to happen to the air? And the answer is the air going to just sit there, or is it going to fill the box? And what happens in reality is the air tends to fill the box and move around, and eventually it becomes stabilized so that all the little molecules have the energy equally distributed amongst the molecules. The molecules are bouncing back and forth, colliding with other molecules in the box. And within a very short time, the cloud of gas fills the box, and the energy distribution is universally equal across the box. In other words, there is not some method of holding that gas up there without physically holding it there. The gas of its own will just distribute through the box, and the energy will distribute equally throughout the box amongst all of the little particles. Let's take a star like the sun. The star is burning. It's going through a process of burning up the energy that is contained in the star, and eventually the assumption is that the star will burn out, that it will eventually be consumed and go into a state that is its lowest energy state, so to speak, and that's how it would exist throughout the rest of its life in the universe. But there are some things that seem to recycle. In other words, possibly this star will fall back into the galactic nucleus. Maybe it will come out and be reignited, and parts of it will form another star someday, etc. So this is the idea of entropy. The basic idea is one of diffusion of energy, that something in a high energetic state will tend to fall to a lower energy state and distribute that energy equal amongst its surrounding. So that's kind of the general issue there. But let me talk about the physical, the human aspect of this. Because a lot of people might say, well, what does entropy have to do with me? And I want to throw this out. I actually threw this out to some scientists over the past week, who are very familiar with entropy and the way it works and the scientific principles involved in entropy. And interestingly enough, I certainly didn't get a consortium or a concurrence of answers, and in most cases, I didn't get an answer at all. And this is from scientists, as I said, who are very familiar with the concept of entropy, the idea of how energy distributes itself with its environment, and like I say, the entire theoretical concept of entropy. But let's look at some human aspects of this. Let's look at nature's course in the universe and the way humans live in this universe. on our planet Earth here, it seems to me that every time human beings tend to alter their environment and try and take control of it, it seems that every time we do that, something bad happens. Now, let's give an example. When we take our efforts, our resources that have been put on this planet, and we, in a sense, reverse entropy and create military products or cars, or we take oil and we burn it, oil that was stored in the earth through a natural process of being diffused off the tail of a comet and falling into Earth. Whenever we take these resources and use them, it seems like we are going against the grain of nature. Now, I want to quote two, not really quote, but I want to exemplify two religions or philosophies of life. I wouldn't really call them religions, but in a sense, a religion, if you look at it as a way of life, you might call it a basically a religion or simply a way of life. The Eastern philosophies and the Native American philosophies both looked at the world as the source of all life. They looked at the sun as the source of all life. And they also understood that you only take what you need, and you give back anything that you take, you have to give back in proportion. Otherwise, the universe will not be supporting you in a short while. And that's actually true. Now, let's look at what has happened with Western philosophy. The idea of capitalism and going out and using natural resources, where the goal, now the stated goal of capitalism, for example, is to become rich, to become wealthy, to become, have so much money that you never have to worry about it, and you can do whatever you want, you can fly around, and of course this is exemplified on TV game shows, where people are jumping up and down trying to win money, and this has been going on for ages. So the view, the casinos where people go and the one person wins, and they think, oh, that's going to be me. I'm going to be the person that wins the big jackpot. When in reality, 99.9% of all the people are losing for that one person to win big. The lottery, how many people wish they won, would win the lottery, and me included. But the point is, look at all the people who have to pay in for that one person to win. And isn't it interesting that the government prevents lotteries being run on a private basis? Only the government can run a lottery. Well, why is that? Because people would soon learn that they could pool their resources and all of them eventually would win the lottery. They could all become a participant. And they remember, in a lottery, there's only one winner, and this winner wins a vast amount of money, so much that they can never spend it all, $300 million or something, you know, these people might win. And then they become vastly wealthy, and everybody else doesn't win anything. But you could take that same $300 million and look at all of the $100,000 prizes you could have in the lottery and make the statistics, the number combinations, much easier to get. And you could have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people winning the lottery. And that would be something that people could really identify with, but they don't. It's just that one person every few weeks that'll win a large chunk of cash. And it keeps everybody putting their money and hoping that they are going to be the one that wins and can bail out of this mad society that we live in, while all of the other people continue to work and work in this madness. So anyway, the point is that nature has a balance. In other words, there should be a philosophy that you take what you need and you leave the rest. That's actually a verse from a song. And there was kind of a philosophy throughout parts of the world through during different times, but now we are in a state where people want more and more. And $400 million is not enough. They have to be a billionaire. They want to be on the Forbes 400 list. I mean, you can't buy more steak. You can't buy a better steak because you have $400 million. So what do these people do with it? They hoard it while there are people starving to death on the planet. It's absolutely ridiculous, but that's the American way, and that seems to be what the rest of the world wants to do. But obviously, there's a trap involved, and eventually those systems break under their own weight. Why am I talking about that now? Because we are actually seeing it happen. So very shortly, people are going to have to go back and realize that the basics of life are all you need. And then you can be happy. You can concentrate on being happy. How many people that are vastly wealthy are really happy? Ask yourself that question. Are they really happy, or does everybody think they are happy? So at any rate, sure, it'd be great to have a lot of money, but it's really going against entropy. The entropy of the universe and the simple things that were put on this earth to make people happy, just to have enough to eat on a daily basis, some clean water, a place to keep in out of the rain, shelter, something on your feet so you can walk around, and the ability to exercise. How many wealthy people are in terrible, terrible physical condition? I remember many times going into the executive office of a CEO or whatever to talk, and always, inevitably, up behind them was a big picture, typically of a Caribbean setting or a cabin in the woods, and I'd say, "What's that?" "Oh, that's my cabin. That's where I'm going to retire." And here's somebody that's got more money than they could ever spend, sitting in a CEO position, and when they get to be 65, they're going to go out and they're probably going to live for about 3 days and then drop dead, living in their cabin that they could have gone to years or decades ago and just existed there and could be happy with way more money than they could ever spend in living in that environment. So entropy is kind of the flow of the universe, if you want to think of it that way, the energy flow. And what we do as humans is we kind of put out our hand and we grab a little bit of that and then have the ability to look around and recognize the universe and be happy. And so what you find is that people are simply going against the grain. Instead of putting their hand out, they're putting a great big net, a voluminous net out to get as much as they can. And the extra actually becomes a burden, not something that makes them happy. And as we see, when people do that, the system collapses under its own weight, and that's what's happening now. And so back to the original point, that entropy is the flow of energy in the universe, and as humans, as people who reverse entropy, we take resources and actually use them and take free energy, so to speak, and put it into our system so that we can exist, actually contradicting or going against the grain of entropy. If you start taking more of natural resources, making them into warfare equipment, starting to get a psycho about it to where you always need war and more money, and that cycle continues, that flow of energy is always going to turn against the human race. So, at any rate, that's just a little bit of pontificating regarding entropy and the flow of energy in the universe. Next, I want to talk about comets. And we usually think of a comet as a big, they call it like a Mickey Mouse, a star with a tail. But, and you look up in the sky, we had Comet Holmes, we've had some very big visible comets, we had Comet Hale-Bopp, Hyakutake back in the 90s where they were very visible. Recently we've had many comets, Comet Holmes, where You could see it with the naked eye, and with binoculars you could see the vast coma that was literally at the end, about six times the volume of our sun. It was out beyond the orbit of Mars. I'll be doing some updates on Comet Holmes here soon. But that's typically what we think of when we talk about a comet. There are many, 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 many objects in space which act like comets, but we really don't see them or think of them as comets. Now, what is a comet? The standard science would try and convince you that it's a dirty snowball. It's got ice on it. When it gets near the heat of the sun, the solar radiation hits that ice and melts it. That's the standard incorrect concept of a comet. And it's really not true. The actual cause of a comet, the thing we see, it's a discharge of the solar capacitor. And the tail that you see is actually material, dust, ions, and atoms forming ions as they come in the electric field of the comet nucleus. That is a comet. And there are many parts of the comet that you don't see. There's an electron beam which comes out from the sun and nails the comet nucleus on the front side. And that's part of the electrical discharge. And that's something you don't see with equipment. You can see the X-ray trace or the ultraviolet light that comes from that electron beam as it enters the comet coma. But basically, a comet is the discharge of the solar capacitor caused by an object, the comet nucleus, an asteroid or chunk of rock or whatever it is. Any item out there, if you threw a tennis ball out in the solar wind, it would become a comet because it discharges that solar wind. The space shuttle, any spacecraft, the moon acts like a comet. It has a large sodium tail. All the planets, all the moons of all the planets discharge the solar capacitor. And so all of these objects, in a sense, could be classified as a comet. Or a type of comet, because they are literally acting the same way as the comets we normally call comets. The small dust particles, any small dust particle has the potential to exchange electrical energy with its environment and create a small localized discharge, thus also becoming a comet in the true sense of the word. Objects in orbit around the Earth. Now, in my weather book, I talk about the many, what we call local environmental batteries. That's the name I coined in the book, Local Environmental Batteries, LEBs, and there are about 17 of them around Earth. Let me just give you an example of one and how it works. When the solar wind, which is electrons and protons, positively and negatively charged particles. When the proton wind when the solar wind comes out towards Earth, it meets our magnetic field, and the protons swing around one side of the Earth, and the electrons swing around the other side of the Earth. That separation of charge creates a battery. And that battery, guess what? Earth is right smack dab in the middle of that battery. That's one of the main sources of battery or voltage that crosses Earth. And this is out in outer space, probably 20 Earth radii out in space on each side of Earth. That's one source of battery. There are, like I said, 17 more, and they are very subtle, they're very intricate in the way they form, in the way they respond to the solar wind. Another one is simply the fact that Earth, as I said, acts as a comet. It discharges the solar capacitor, and that causes another cross voltage on the Earth. And all of these interact in a very interesting manner. So let's look at an object like a satellite, like an asteroid, like a chunk of matter that's just coming through by Earth from outer space, passing by Earth, that passes through this zone. It's passing through that electric field. It'll discharge it in outer space. There, in outer space, there is no resistance as you would find in a wire. When we typically think of electrical circuits on Earth, we think of a wire and a battery. In outer space, you have the battery but no wire. So charge is free to move relatively quickly, and so an object moving through this battery or capacitor will discharge it and, in fact, become a comet. So every place you find a voltage difference, which in a sense we call a capacitor, every place you find that in outer space, whether it's near Earth, whether it's near Jupiter, whether it's near little Pluto, way out in the far reaches of the solar system, whether it's relative to the sun and the solar wind, whether it's no matter where the source of voltage is in outer space, then an object passing through that voltage will discharge it and form a comet. So this is the reason I'm mentioning this is because I want to diffuse the idea that a comet is just one of those things we see up in the sky. And part of the deception here of the dirty snowball comet model is that imagine something big. Let's imagine something that's in orbit around the sun. Some people might call it Planet X. And of course, I've given lectures on this show, entire series of lectures on the many Planet X objects. And the human reaction to that, the historical record of many multiple big comets coming into the solar system at one time, of Venus becoming a planet recently in a number of thousands of years ago from a large comet. Not all comets, as you can see, become planets. Not every little dust grain out there is going to become a planet. So part of the concept that I'm trying to put across is that any object, small or large in outer space, could be identified as a comet or having comet properties. That is simply the discharge of the local electrical battery. So everything from the smallest dust grain up to the largest possible orbiting object of our sun. And so here's what you would see if you were an astronomer. Say you were looking out, as NASA is doing right now, finding thousands. Remember that NASA announced a week or two ago that they have discovered in the past couple of years thousands of planets. And their new vision of the solar system, I'm glad they're catching on. Their new vision of the solar system is that there are thousands of planets in the solar system. Imagine a big object coming in. Here's what you would see if you were an astronomer. First, you would see sunlight reflecting off of this faint object. And let's imagine that it's, let's say, the size of Jupiter or larger. So that would be about 10 times the diameter of Earth, an object that big or larger. And all of a sudden, you see it in outer space. You do some calculations based on a couple weeks or a couple months of observations, and you decide that this object is on an orbit that eventually will bring it into the solar system. This area that the sun has generated a capacitor out beyond the orbit of Pluto. But if this object is out there farther, you would just see the faint light reflected from our own sun, and it would look like a round object. But as soon as it breaks into the solar capacitor, it's going to begin to discharge it, and it's going to start to look like a huge comet. So, when a Planet X type object comes into the solar system, it is not going to look like some kind of round object. It's going to look like a comet. And not just your average comet, it's going to be a vast raging comet. So when people look up, they're going to see this object, and of course the news media will mimic and resound the NASA nursery rhyme, "Oh, don't mind that. That's just one of those little dirty snowballs. It's just a little comet," and try and keep that ridiculous image that that's a comet That's different from a planet, so don't look at that comet over there. And so that's why, number one, I believe NASA had to make the announcement that there are thousands of objects in the solar system that could be categorized as planets, because they have to be in the forefront in the news media to keep the public diffused when an object comes into this solar system and erupts into a big comet. So you see the misinformation, the formula, the plan for deception. You see it all in place. And why would NASA make that announcement? Why would the Discovery Channel a couple weeks ago promote a group in Japan that claims that within a couple weeks or months they should have discovered, or they will have discovered, Planet X, an object at least Earth-sized that is in orbit around the Sun with a few thousand-year orbit, and they are actually calling it Planet X. I think they're prepping the public for first view of such an object. But what's interesting is in the public announcements of NASA and the Discovery Channel of these scientists in Japan, what they always show is a big round planet, like some artist's conception that here, round planet. Don't confuse that with the comet over here. And they certainly don't want you to imagine that something looking like a big comet is anything but a dirty little harmless snowball. So you can see where that's going. And that's why tonight I wanted to talk about the many types of comets, so you have a good understanding that everything out in space that exists, whether it's near Earth in one of its local electrical batteries, whether it's out by Jupiter in one of the local capacitors of Jupiter or Saturn. I talked last week about Rhea, the moon of Saturn, and also it exists in the capacitor around Saturn, and why scientists are seeing a drop in electrons, because it is negatively charged. It's acting like a comet, the moon Rhea of Saturn. So I talked about that last week. The whole idea here is that you now have a good understanding that a comet is any object in space, whether it's a dust particle, a tennis ball, a spacecraft, the space shuttle, a moon rocket, whether it's the Japanese space probe going to the moon to take photographs of the moon. No matter what the object is, or whether it's a huge planetary-type object coming into our solar system, that all of these will be discharging some type of capacitor and have comet-like properties. Now, not all of them will develop a visible tail. There will be an electrical discharge, and in many cases, you can't see that. There are many asteroids out there and minor planets which are discharging the solar capacitor but do not have a large visible tail. So I want to make that very clear. The conditions for forming a tail are very precise, and not all of these objects will be forming a tail that is visible. There would be detectable, if you got right up next to them, had good equipment, you would be able to detect tail-like activity, but they're not always visible as a comet tail. Venus has a tail which extends out to Earth, part of which contains those viruses that we get every time it comes between us and the Sun. So I hope that gives you an understanding of the properties of comets. And once again, I am out of time. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.